Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Today's Football Times with me, Aidan Williams. It's our monthly discussion podcast on current football matters from These Football Times. We've got a few topics to get through today, but our main focus will be the FA Cup. As we record this, the semi-finals are about to be played, with the final taking place a fortnight later, all at an empty Wembley, of course, so it'll be slightly different to what we're used to. To help us guide through it all, we've got a stellar lineup of guests as always. And since we're on an FA Cup theme, I thought I'd do the introductions based on FA Cup in the order of when each of their respective teams last won the tournament. So that means up first, firing us into a great start like Roberto Di Matteo after only 42 seconds, which is more or less where we are in the pod as well. Gary, it's our Chelsea supporting man in Spain. Mr. Thacker, how are you?
Oh, good, thanks, mate. And that was smooth. Tournament segue into an introduction, buddy. That was brilliant, yeah.
Well, yeah, of course, Chelsea won it a couple of years ago, didn't they?
Yeah, we beat Man United in year before last. So
add to it, Gary, you might not know this, but you've won it five times since either of our other two guest sides have. Yeah. So bragging rights are definitely with you.
Thank you very much. We've got a great pedigree in the FA Cup of late and also in the FA Youth Cup. And if you added those two together, I think we'd won something like 12 in the last 8 years or something like that. Crazy amount of but you know, I'm not complaining. Yes, so I'll take that five since the other guys have done it. Yeah, okay.
Well, next up with the trophy drought that literally nobody has been talking about is our Liverpool supporting regular Stephen Scragg. Your interventions tonight will surely be as iconic as the last minute Stephen Gerrard thunderbolt. 2006, Stephen, what on earth have Liverpool been doing since then?
Underachieving in the FA Cup, I think, is the honest assessment there. Yes, you know, we've kind of gone back to the days that I remember as a kid, because you know, the FA Cup as a kid for a long time was something that it just wasn't a Liverpool thing. We just didn't win it. It took a long time from my football consciousness for us to win it, and we seem to have regressed to those days again.
Well, at least you've got something else to keep you on the up.
Exactly.
To give us a bit of Merseyside blue to balance things out and keep our equilibrium, combining the knowledge of Howard Kendall and the clinical finishing of Graham Sharp and Andy Gray, it's our favourite Evertonian, Paul McParlan. Great to have you on the pod, Paul. It's 1995, it was for you, the last Everton success, memorable cup final victory over Man United.
Yes, it was. Seems like a lifetime ago now, that one. And can I just point out as well that although Di Matteo scored that goal after 34 seconds, Luis Sahar for Everton now holds the record for the quickest FA Cup final goal, which he scored for Chelsea.
Very true, very true. And for fairness, I should also point out I'd have very much been last in this list of introductions. 1955 for me in Newcastle United. And on the occasion of the previous fastest goal, of course, Jackie Milburn used to be the record holder of that until Di Matteo stole that away. But yeah, the less said about Newcastle's successes and trophies, the better. Gary's talk of 12 and 8 years, well, you know, we're lucky if we get 12 Man of the Match awards in that amount of time. There we go. Anyway, before we get into our FA Cup discussions, a couple of other items we want to discuss from recent weeks. So firstly, of course, there's sad news that came through at the end of last week about the death of Jack Charlton. He was, of course, a footballing legend, both as a player and a manager, and spent his entire career with Leeds United, and in fact still holds the record for number of appearances at that club, just one ahead of Billy Bremner. Also part of England's World Cup winning team of 66, of course, along with his brother Bobby. He was the rock partnering the more silky skills of Bobby Moore at the centre of defence. After his playing days, he went on to manage at club level with Middlesbrough, most prominently, then Sheffield Wednesday and Newcastle briefly, before taking over Ireland, having, of course, had his application for the England job ignored in the late 70s, as with Mr. Clough. He took Ireland, of course, to unprecedented success, all with a rather robust, unapologetic style, but it was an approach that very much epitomised his no-nonsense outlook as a footballer and a person. Paul, coming to you first, it's a sad loss indeed for quite a hero of the game.
Yeah, I think it's worth remembering as well that Jackie Charlton was like an influential footballer a footballing figure for the best part of five decades, you know, from the 1950s right through to the 1990s, both as a player and as a manager. Yeah, I mean, he was a one-off character. I don't think you know someone would be allowed to voice their opinions post-match these days the way that he was able to in his playing pomp. But real sad loss to the game, and it's it's always a blow when one of the World Cup winners departs this earth. You know, there's only five of them left now. Always like Jackie Charles, and as a player, and to any aspiring young schoolboy who doubts their own talents, he was just a perfect role model because he wasn't the best footballer, he wasn't the most skillful, but in his position at that time, you know, he was. There was nobody who could touch his qualities. And I always like that quote from Alf Ramsey when Jack approached him to ask, well, why are you picking me, Alf? And Alf says, you know, Jack, I don't always pick the best players for my team. You know, he picked players to fit the system. So, you know, in terms of what he brought to Leeds and what he brought to England, because undoubtedly he made Bobby Moore a better player because he allowed Bobby Moore the time and space to get forward and pass the ball to the forwards. And I think his contribution is sometimes underestimated.
Absolutely. And how do you think he'll be remembered, Gary, in terms of the player and the manager, I guess? I mean, in Ireland, he's a legend, of course, isn't he?
Oh, absolutely. There's a wonderful tale about, and you want these things to be true. You just want them to be true. But the Jack Charlton, obviously, this is after he'd sort of... He left managing Ireland, but he loved fishing, and he spent a lot of time in Ireland fishing down there in the different parts of the country. And he'd always find your way into a local pub for lunch. And as he walked in, people, you can't miss Jack Charlton. Nobody knows Jack Charlton. And he'd always buy a round of drinks for everybody in the pub. And, you know, he'd have his lunch in there, and he'd always pay the bartender with a cheque, knowing that the bartender is never going to cash it in a frame and put it beyond the bar. Now, I mean, I hope it's true, but it's a classic tale of so many things that, you know, how much the guy was loved in Ireland and respected. And, you know, people say, you know, on the one side of the TV, they have a framed photo of the Pope. On the other side is a framed photo of Jack Charlton. he took Republic of Ireland football to unexpected levels, undreamt of levels of success. Quarterfinals, the World Cup, you know, beating Italy in Italia 90, in USA 94. So super. As a player, sort of doing this backwards on that, as a player, it was always sort of, because I'm a Chelsea fan, there was always this massive rivalry between Chelsea and Leeds in the 70s. And, you know, I used to, you know, I hate that it's not the right word, but I was always good. Fed up of him because he'd always had this, and he admitted he had this little black book that players that he played against who'd been a bit sort of less than truly sporting, shall we say, that he was always going to pay back. And he always used to say, we seem to have a team for Peter Osgood. But, and Paul used the phrase earlier, he was absolute rock as a defender, very much of his age. He fitted the template that Don Revie wanted to play. He fitted the template that Sir Alf Ramsey wanted to play. So as a player, a legend. As a manager, even more of a legend, probably.
Well, indeed, especially with Ireland, of course.
And, indeed.
Stephen, do you think it ever sort of mattered the style of play he promoted, or is that just merely enhancing the legend of sort of the stubbornness, or the unapologeticness of it, the approach of, well, I'm not going to adjust for anyone else. They've got to deal with us.
Yeah, definitely. It was very much a case of, what's the word I'm going to be looking for here? Almost like a brusque style of football for a brusque style of man, you know. But there was always something, you know, admirable about both him as a personality and his football. You know, there was, you know, no matter how, I wouldn't even say they were a physical side. They weren't a violent side as such. Violent, again, they're not the right word, but, you know, the terminology of saying a team is physical tends to be, you know, read between the lines, and they're you know, a set of hackers, and they weren't. You know, that was an Ireland side that had a lot of very, very good players, and, you know, notoriously a lot of the ball playing midfielders would get frustrated because the ball would be flying over their heads for a lot of the game. But, you know, they could play football. I can't remember what the goal was now. There was one that was put on not so long ago. It was one of the qualifiers for a World Cup game, and it was just pure fluid football. and they could play, they could turn it on when they needed to. But yes, they played to a set framework in a similar way to how Graham Taylor's teams played, was that there was a kind of strict pattern, there was a framework to them, and players would play in a specific area of the pitch that was meant to be theirs, and they were just so effective, and that was the thing about them, and which made it so admirable. And they were watchable. You know, you can get teams who, you know, take a robust approach to the game and be completely unwatchable. Yeah, Ireland were quite hypnotic because they come from nowhere as well, which probably played a big part in the fact that, you know, people were so absorbed by them. And Jack Charlton was just the perfect man to be, you know, in charge of that and to inspire that. And I think it was great for me is that it was just such a case of two fingers up at the English FA. You know, he'd applied for the England job in, I think it was 77. Didn't even get a response from the FA. You know, not a kind of, you know, let alone an interview. There was no response to the application, and that hurt him. You know, the way that he was dealt with by the FA. So to kind of come back and kind of prove a point in some way at Euro 88 by beating England. You know, he was proud to play for England. He was proud of being a World Cup winner, but he was hurt by, you know, that response or non-response by the FA. And to go and do what he did and be such a thorn in the side of England, you know, it was almost like a little bit of karma in such a way. But I love Jack Charlton. He was absolutely outstanding. And just one of those people that, you know, if when he was being interviewed, there's not always the case for me that I would sit and watch or read an interview of someone. But Jack Charlton was just one of those that was always came up with something that was just so valid, on the point, and brutally honest as well.
Absolutely. I mean, I've seen one of the things that's been doing the rounds on Twitter since he died was him presenting an award to his brother, Bobby, of course. And the contrast between the two is quite startling in personality terms and in playing style, but both equally valid and both valuable in a team, and of course they combined in that World Cup winning team, and both of them making their contributions and helping the team on the way. So a sad loss indeed. But Stephen, while we're with you, it'd also be a bit remiss of us not to mention that Liverpool have been crowned Premier League champions since we last did one of these pods, so first league title in 30 years. That does sound incredible to me as someone whose football memories began in the 80s, where Liverpool were quite dominant, along with Everton too, I should add, before Paul jumps in there. But Liverpool were so well used to league success at that time, it would have surely been inconceivable back then to think how long they'd have to wait for another title. But in terms of this current side, how do you think this team compares to some of the past Liverpool sides, especially the title-winning ones?
It's hard to compare eras that are so detached. We're talking in terms of title-winning sides, but, you know, in terms of, you know, the way that they play and the entertainment that they've given, you know, they're up there with the very best of Liverpool title winning sides in my lifetime. You know, the benchmarks as when it comes to Liverpool title winning sides has always been 1978-79. You know, ever since that side, it was a Dalglish up front with David Johnson, that epic midfield of Souness, McDermott, Jimmy Case and Ray Kennedy, and, you know, Clements in goal, and a defence that read Phil Neal, Phil Thompson, Alan Hansen, Alan Kennedy, you know, and it was a side that changed very, very little. Emily Hughes was still knocking around. It was his last season. Steve Highway as well, David Fairclough, who all chipped in with valuable contributions, but it was a side that was just so, again, using the word ruthless, they were ruthless and they were efficient. And, you know, you occasionally get those sides that would transcend eras, and that was one of them. And then 87-88, which was the Barnes-Beardsley-Aldridge side. So out of sides, yes, it was a team that has won the title. And if you are going to have a 30-year hiatus in winning the title, you know, you're going to be enthusiastic about that title that you win. But I think I think given the style of football, you know, this was, you know, it will stand the test of time and its way up there as far as, you know, Liverpool title winning sides.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, from my perspective, I think they're eminently more likeable than quite a number of other Liverpool sides, certainly in the last few decades. I would say that just the characters of the players, the sort of infectious enthusiasm of Klopp.
Yeah, I think yeah, I mean, that going off what other fans of other teams say, you know, when you've got certain level-headed Manchester United fans saying that we wish we had him and that, you know, he's so hard to dislike. You know, try as you might, you know, he's difficult to dislike because he's just has got this infectious personality. And he's so likeable, and the fact that what he does is he does so much of what he creates is down to kind of like simplicity, and it's the collective. There's a kind of socialism at play, and it's just a very attractive style of management. You know, when you're getting people turning around saying that he should be prime minister and stuff like that, you know, it's down to the fact that, you know, some of the stuff that he talks about, you know, not even about football, you know, and he just comes out with common sense in an era when it's sadly lacking on a daily basis.
Indeed. I mean, Gary, your side is, of course, one of those left in Liverpool's wake at the moment. Chelsea may have been recent league winners, but quite some distance behind currently, certainly in terms of points, if not so much in league places. How do you see the league title challenge going forward? Do you think we'll see Liverpool dominance again as this season, or a two-horse race of the previous year? Or can anybody else raise themselves to live with them?
It's a really difficult thing, this. You know, I mean, Liverpool have won this by a straight. You know, Man City weren't second. Freshet is second. Freshet is third.
Yes.
Man City might be fourth, and, you know, and then we'll count down from there. But, you know, it isn't, you know, a few years ago, City broke the points record. And I think Liverpool just can't do it now because they lost to Arsenal. And we think, oh, no, this City going to win everything now for the next 10 years. They didn't. And, you know, when Mourinho arrived at Chelsea and they won back-to-back titles, and Chelsea going to win everything for 10 years. They didn't. And it's so difficult to predict the future, especially in the Premier League, because, you know, no matter how things look at one, you know, in any given time, the wheel always turns, and it might not turn next season, but, you know, and you know, it's entertaining to see that Liverpool have sort of rose up to sort of compete with Man City, because, you know, nobody wants a league dominated by one club. It's far, far more entertaining to have at least two clubs, you know, vying for the title, although perhaps City isn't vying for it this year. But something will change in the next few years. Nobody, 3 years ago, 2 years ago, there'll be very few people saying Liverpool will beat City by 20-odd points and walk away with the league, having won the European Cup the previous year. Nobody would have predicted that. The one thing about the Premier League, so difficult to predict, I think Liverpool will be, and City will be done next year. It's difficult to see anybody else raising a real challenge. I mean, you know, it would be great to see Chelsea up there, but I think we'll probably be chasing third place along with a lot of other teams. So I think next season will be a duopoly between City and Liverpool. And, I'll, you know, put my money on anybody, I'll put it on Liverpool the way they're playing at the moment, because they play some fantastic football. But 2 years down the road, 3 years down the road, we might be in a different situation, because if history teaches us something, it's that history never repeats itself.
Indeed. Paul, I'll spare you from sharing your thoughts on Liverpool, but one other theme of this Premier League season has been the lack of a challenge, but not just that, but a fairly lacklustre relegation scrap. And aside from the revelation that has been Sheffield United in this league and the great progress made by Wolves and Burnley, to some extent, I guess, it's been fairly predictable overall, the Premier League. Aside from the sheer scale of Liverpool's dominance, I suppose. But if you compare it to the Championship, things seem rather more evenly matched, more competitive and more exciting as a result. It's quite a contrast, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think at this stage of the season now, 17 out of 24 Championship teams still have something to play for. You've got about 9 teams in danger of going down. You've still got Everton down to 9th place has a possibility of making the playoffs. You've also got the spectre of some potential fines and point deductions hanging over the likes of Wigan Athletic and Sheffield Wednesday. And it just seems every week in the Championship, it's almost impossible to predict what a result is going to be on every given Saturday. I mean, Leeds United, you know, the best team in the league by a mile, but they've had their little hiccups. They've dropped points at places you'd least expect them to. And it, as a spectacle, it's just been really, really engrossing from the start of the season to where we are now with two games to go. And you've got the likes of Hull City, who lost 8-0 on Wednesday, but if they win the next two games, could actually still stay up. So everything's still to play for in the Championship. And I don't know if any of the panellists watching the Football League show on Quest with Colin Murray, but it's so much better than Match of the Day in terms of what you're watching, the quality of football on offer. And you know, to me, football only survives by being competitive. You need a competitive league to keep interest going. Now, the Premier League hasn't been competitive this season. It's been a total one-horse race, which is great for Stephen, but not so great for the rest of us. And certainly from the Championship's point of view, you know, if you're a supporter of any of those teams in the league table, you're going into the last two games of the season knowing there's still something at stake. And to me, you know, that is just absolutely brilliant.
Indeed. I mean, we've also seen Leagues 1 and 2 maybe more competitive in many ways, but they decided against completing their schedules, of course, similar to the Scottish League. Now, there's reason behind this, financial, in the case of the English lower leagues, but in cutting things off ahead of fulfilling all their fixtures, there's winners and losers in that situation. So in League One, they took this points per game option to decide the final placing. That saw Wycombe Wanderers leap from eighth to third, straight into the playoffs, which they ultimately won the other night against Oxford. So they've now gone up to the Championship. At the other end, Tranmere, of course, got relegated by 0.06 of a point per game. When they did have 10 games to play when the league was suspended, which must be rather frustrating for them and their fans. Is Tranmere's plight a bit of a unifying factor from our two scousers here? And any thoughts on their unfortunate situation?
I feel for any team that's been involved in a league that wasn't allowed to finish. You know, the variables that were still there to play out, you know, fixture lists that would have been very, very different. Some teams would have had a harder run in, some teams would have had a more difficult run in. You've got to take, you know, nerve, you know, a test of nerve. You know, we've seen teams before that have pulled off the great escape that looks completely unlikely. You've seen teams that have plummeted into a relegation battle because they've taken it for granted that they're out of it. I'm no doubt that if those leagues had played out, some of the teams that went up still would have gone up, some of the teams that went down still would have gone down, but not all of them. You know, some of them have had their own fate taken out of their hands. I greatly believe that, you know, I can understand why it was done. You know, the finances down in those divisions are completely different than they are in the higher divisions. But yes, I do feel for not just Tranmere, but anyone who has missed out by such a narrow and mathematical margin.
Paul, what's your thoughts on Tranmere and their sad relegation?
Yeah, I mean, I'd agree with most of what Stephen said there. I think the Tranmere situation, you know, it's unique in the history of football, isn't it? And I remember Mickey Mellon being interviewed on TV about 2 weeks ago saying, we're the only club in history to be relegated by a calculator. And I think he was spot on with that comment as well. And look, to me, the whole points per game thing doesn't take into account current form at all. So you could, like, if that had been used in the Premier League this season, then Leicester would have finished far higher than what they deserve to on current form, because their current form has been awful. But Tranmere had just come off the back of three away wins. They just brought in two strikers during the January window who were just settling into the side. They were on an upward vibe, and then suddenly the season has stopped and they don't get the chance to progress. If you look at the final league table, they were 3 points behind Wimbledon, but with a game in hand. So it just seemed really unfair, you know, for that to happen. And it's also the implication and the knock-on effects of that as well, because, you know, Mickey Mellon has now gone to Dundee United. Now, maybe he would have stayed at Tranmere had kept their place in League One. One or two of the Tranmere players will be leaving this summer. And this is a club that's come back from the dead. This is a club that, you know, was in the Vauxhall Conference and on the basis of two successive promotions has got themselves into League One. Now, I have total respect for likes of Mark Pallas and what he's done for the club there. And to me, it just seems an absolute hammer blow. And I mean, one of the things I was wondering was, could they not have done like sort of a playoff type system similar to what they do in the National League, whereby you had the four playoff contenders from League Two, and you had Tranmere and Wimbledon from League One who were in sort of 21st and 20th places, and maybe some sort of knockout competition between them. So at least you went down on a football basis rather than a mathematical calculation basis. Because to me, it just doesn't seem right that you lose your league place based on a calculation in an office. And I think there's also the point as well that I know they made the argument that cost-wise it wasn't viable. But to me, the league should have some consistency. If that was the model for League One, League Two, it should have been the model for the Championship. I don't see how in a league structure like that, in the professional part of the game, they can have two different systems operating. And I just think the way Tranmere have become the victims of this, it's quite unfair. I feel really sorry for the club. It's a lovely club. The fans are great. It's brilliant atmosphere there. And on the other hand, Wickham Wanderers, you know, they finished eighth. They're now going to the Championship. You know, they've leapfrogged Sunderland and Peterborough to get that final playoff place. And to me, that also doesn't seem right.
I can live with that one, though, actually, if we see Sunderland stay down.
I knew you let that play.
I'd just add to that. I think they've missed a really golden opportunity as well, is to restructure the league pyramid as well. That would have been a way of getting around it as well. You know, considering the financial burden that has been placed on so many clubs, and you're looking at clubs going to, you don't have to look at Wigan Athletic and how, you know, the owners have thrown them under the bus in the last week or so. You know, this was a big opportunity you look at the gaps between the leagues is what always draws my eye. And so many of the teams that are playing at kind of like League One level are so kind of behind the Championship even. You know, you always say that chasm between the Championship and the Premier League is big enough, and the gambling to get in there to be able to have this huge payday. You know, I do think there was a missed opportunity here to restructure the league. I'm a great advocate that I think, you know, England should go down the route of how Germany do it, where the Bundesliga is run in the top two divisions. You know, I would say that's a far better way to do it, and cut the Football League loose to say, look, you structure the lower leagues basically. You know, they could have had regionalised third divisions there to ease the pain somewhat. Within that, you wouldn't have had teams relegated from the third to the fourth tier, because you'd have had two third tiers. You know, so it would have been a chance to bring in clubs from the National League. I was going to call it the Conference then, but the National League would have been, you know, so you would have been able to have this three pronged football league almost. You know, there was a big opportunity here to set a lot of football's ills right, which I think they've just, you know, blinked and thought, no, the status quo is easier, and if a few clubs fall by the wayside, then so be it.
Yeah, and I guess the argument against the regionalisation is that the quality of each individual league is more stretched and potentially therefore less competitive, but financial issues, the way that many teams are struggling. We lost Bury, of course, this season. And as you say, Wigan are in big trouble now. And the crippling finances of the current situation for these smaller professional teams. It makes a lot of sense to keep the clubs afloat, doesn't it?
If you look at kind of like the way that the third, you know, League One and League Two, they miss out so much on kind of like, you know, TV exposure and the chance to make money, you know, because you have teams in the National League who often make more in that respect because, you know, they have their own bespoke contract with BT Sport. So when Sky show the Football League, they have the rights to the Football League and they're showing live games, but they'll predominantly focus on the Championship. So Leagues One and League Two don't really get that much of a look in. as far as kind of like live exposure. There'll be teams that will have, you know, more live games being in the National League than they will do in League Two. So, you know, the teams that have been promoted from the National League this season going into League Two will find that all that television exposure last year on BT disappears. And you know, they'll be lucky to be covered in a live game on Sky next season. And it just seems odd that, you know, you have this schism where, you know, basically the fifth division has more television exposure than the third and the fourth do. And I really do believe there's a, you know, a better way of doing it.
But a missed opportunity, as you say, never even considered, really, was it? But anyway, let's move on to the FA Cup now. Half an hour in, we'll get on to our main subject eventually. It's been a topic of discussion for some time that the FA Cup is, of course, in decline. There's complaints about weakened lineups, some teams seemingly hoping to get knocked out as soon as possible, simply to enhance their hopes of finishing 13th rather than 14th in the league. Recent finals, though, have been largely the domain of the same few usual suspects, the bigger clubs with the greater resource and depth dominating, even if they do rest some of their main stars. Some stats on that. This year's semi-finalists are made up of the winners of the last six Cups, and beyond that, the winners of 10 of the last 11, only Wigan in 2013 being the exception there. Gary, do you think the increased strength in depth of these big clubs is leaving the competition beyond the reaches of any prospective giant killers now?
Yep. Oh, sorry, shall I say some more? If you look at the, you know, just sort of underscoring what you just said, Aidan, you know, if we, from the start of this century, the winners have been in order: Chelsea, Liverpool, Arsenal, Man United, Arsenal, Liverpool, Chelsea. There was Portsmouth, Chelsea, Man City, Chelsea, Wigan Athletic, Arsenal, Man United, Arsenal, Chelsea, Man City. Now, there are two standout performances there, Portsmouth and Wigan, in 20 years. And that's probably about the chances that a non-top, shall we say, top six club have got to break into. If the top six clubs are serious about winning the trophy. And it seems to be that they are. And it's sort of a reflection of this is that, especially in recent years, when City have been dominating the league and Liverpool have now, the FA Cup has become more important to the non-top two teams, if you can see what I'm saying. Because they're not going to win the league trophy, not going to win the league title. I mean, you know, the likes of Chelsea, Man United, and to some extent Man City as well, Arsenal, their chances of competing for the league title disappeared somewhere around about November the 4th, you know. And so it became, I'm exaggerating a little bit, but you see what I'm saying. So the FA Cup suddenly becomes really important. It's the major domestic trophy they can compete for. And as long as you get a duopoly of teams competing for the Premier League, or even one, as in this case, in this season it was, the FA Cup becomes even more important. And although the, you know, clubs, and I think we beat Liverpool in the quarterfinals, and I said at the time to Steve, you know, our reserves were better than your reserves, and that's about the stage of it at that sort of time of the competition. And the, you know, top clubs play their reserve players, but even the reserve players of the, you know, the top five or six clubs tend to be better than the, you know, the sort of bulk of the Premier League. I'm not saying that's nice, I'm just saying that's true. And if people don't think it's true, look at the results, because the results bear out the theory.
They do, but what about, Paul, more middling teams like yours and mine? This should be seen as a big opportunity to really go for silverware. You know, neither of our clubs are going to win the league. FA Cup and League Cup is our only real hope. And yet, you don't always get the feeling that it's prioritised. Sometimes it's quite explicit. In the Mike Ashley era at Newcastle, it was very much, the policy was to not try in the Cups until more recently. Do you think clubs like ours could do more to try and challenge the big clubs? And even if they're playing their reserves, that should leave them beatable to some extent by Everton, Newcastle and other clubs of that stature.
Yeah, I'd agree. I mean, Newcastle's stance towards the FA Cup in recent times, given Newcastle's proud history and pedigree in that competition, has always just confounded me, because I know the fans like yourself would be desperate for FA Cup success, and I just don't understand why the club hasn't made that a priority, as opposed to finishing 13th, 14th or 15th in the Premier League. As for Everton, I think the club has always prioritised the FA Cup. And no, the FA Cup, no, it's the last trophy that we won, so that is always something to hang on to there. And certainly for the likes of any side outside of these top five, top six, the FA Cup represents their best opportunity of A, winning an honour, and B, securing a European place. So I think from the Everton fan base, we're really anxious for the team to do well in the FA Cup. You know, we got to the final in 2009, where Gary's team beat us. We would love to go back there again. And I think we hold the proud record of losing more semi-finals than any other team. So it shows we do
something.
It is indeed. You take whatever you can get these days. But I think it does show the esteem of which the FA Cup is held, you know, certainly by our set of fans. But I think, you know, if you look as well, I know the top four are kind of dominated in terms of who's won the FA Cup. But this decade, you know, Cardiff got to the final, Stoke got to the final, Hull City have got to the final, Wigan Athletic have got to the final. So there's an opportunity there for middle-ranking teams to get themselves in a showpiece occasion. And yeah, we'll probably get on to talk about what needs to change with the FA Cup in terms of format and things like that during the part of this discussion. But to me, the FA Cup is a trophy that, you know, any team in the Premier League that is not in competition for the title, and that means 19 teams this season, really, they have to make it a priority. And one thing I will say in defence of both Pep Guardiola and Jose Mourinho, who do have their critics, both of those managers always prioritise the FA Cup.
Yeah, and the League Cup too, in both of their cases, I think, is probably fair to say. The team who didn't prioritise it is most definitely Liverpool this season, Stephen. They may have got past Everton with their young players, but how was that perceived? Playing a squad as he did, it was only ever going to go so far, wasn't it? They were never going to get all the way. How was that perceived in a season where you were so far ahead in the league that was it necessary, really?
No, it's never necessary to play that, you know, to downgrade a tournament to such an extent. You know, there's ways and means, you know, squad rotation. You know, squads are that massive and rambling now that you don't need to kind of like, you know, field an under 22, an under 21 side. You know, that's just complete disrespect for a tournament. So, yeah, for me, it was massively uncomfortable. Yes, we won that game against Everton. But, you know, it was done the wrong way. You know, so for me, again, the FA Cup has such tradition, but it has been, it's been neglected for a generation. You know, and I just don't see, you know, why it should have come to that. You know, it didn't have to come to that. And it's been done on a drip-drip basis. There was never a light bulb moment. And it actually started with the League Cup, if I'm honest. You know, once people started to do that type of thing with the League Cup, it soon became transferable to the FA Cup. You know, once Manchester United opted out in 99, 2000, it's just these... It's a case of chipping away at it. That's what's happened to the FA Cup. There hasn't been this, you know, ground zero moment. There hasn't been one detonation. It has just been a series of seasons of neglect. You know, it's that disregard for it has got more and more. They had that point where, for a few seasons, the final was played on, you know, the penultimate Premier League weekend of the season. So there'd be league games being played. There was one where, I can't remember what it was now, there was a final and someone clinched the title on the same day. The title was clinched in an R12 game and the FA Cup final was played at R5. But even that, you know, to play the FA Cup final at R5 seems like an afterthought. It's one of the worst kickoff times of a weekend. I think it's only beaten, in my view, by a Monday night kickoff. So, you know, it's just been utterly neglected, and Liverpool have played their part in that massively over the last, I'd say, 15 years. You know, I'll go back to a third round tie we played at Burnley under Rafa Benitez, the infamous Jimmy Traore back heel into the goal one rainy Friday night. I was there at Turf Moor for that one. One of the most ridiculous Friday nights I've ever experienced. So yeah, you know, it's something that didn't have to happen. You know, there's a collective malaise that some haven't taken part in, and as I can't remember, it was Gary Appall who mentioned it, and now Pep Guardiola has, you know, treated the FA Cup very, very well, as Jose Mourinho. So did Arsene Wenger for a long time. You know, all those Arsenal victories, you know, that sustained him for such a long time when the league titles dried up. There is life in the FA Cup, but you know, it's not across the board though. You know, more needs to be done to resurrect it. It'll never be what it was, but it can be better than it is.
And you think with changes that we've seen recently, things like the five substitutions, and I know we're going to have that next season as well, that's going to play even further into the hands of the big clubs, not just in the Cup, of course, in all competitions. The big teams with the greater strength and depth, making it harder still for others to break through. But you're right, it has been chipped away at over the years. How to restore it then is quite a tricky thing. It, as you said, Stephen, it's never going to go back to what it was. The lovely memories we all have of cup final day and watching the TV all day and building up to the final, so on, that's never going to reappear.
I would say that, yeah, you can't do that. You can't put it back to what it was, but you can create a new kind of special for it. You know, it can have its own niche again. But it's like moving forward and trying to implement something that is quite unique. And it's that uniqueness that the FA Cup lost that it needs to try and regain. It needs to have things that are unique to it. And you can add, you know, parts of the past to that. But, you know, you can do that as part of moving on. It's like the 3 o'clock Saturday kickoff that was just so iconic. You know, the sun beating down, the shadow of the old Wembley Stadium roof that would, you know, envelop part of the pitch. You know, it's just the little incidentals that made an FA Cup final day, FA Cup final day. And you can do that again. You know, you can do that type of thing again, but make it different. You know, ensure it's the last game of the season. You know, give it a prime time kickoff. If that means it being something like 7 p.m. on a Saturday night, then do it. You know, I think 5:30, you know, people are making the tea, the kids want the food, you know. No, do it where, yes, you do have that kind of build-up to it, you know, that people can sit there for an hour or so and make it special. You know, the FA Cup semi-finals, you know, away from Wembley, that's such an awful thing. You know, it's such a simple thing to do. You know, there are so many simple things that can be done to make it a better thing again.
Well, we had a question from one of our listeners, Ross Kilvington, on exactly that, talking about the semi-finals at Wembley, basically asking, have they taken away from the magic of the cup? I mean, to me, that's a clear yes. Is it as simple as a simple fix for that particular issue, Gary, to restore a little bit of the mystique and drama of it by playing them in a smaller but more compact and atmospheric stadium?
It'll make a difference. Will it make the difference? Not a chance in hell. I think, you know, we have to be careful here that we don't sort of con ourselves by putting, you know, roasting the glasses on. I mean, I mentioned earlier about, you know, from 2000, the winners of the FA Cup. But I just want, so, you know, the disappearing magic of the Cup isn't anything new, particularly. I mean, I'll go back after the Wimbledon victory in 1988. The winners were Liverpool, Man United, Tottenham, Liverpool, Arsenal, Man United, Everton, Man United, Chelsea. There's nothing changed.
Yeah, the big winners there, but a variation, I'd say. Well, and there was still, for a lot of teams then, there was still that kind of aura that this meant something. You know,
You misunderstand what I'm saying, Steve. The point I'm making is that, you know, big teams were still winning the trophy in those days. So, you know, moving the FA Cup semi-final to Wembley, which I disagree with entirely as well, didn't help matters at all. If we want to change the FA Cup, you've almost, this sounds a bit crazy to say it, but if the problem is big teams winning it, we've almost got to make it less important. Now, by that, I don't mean downgrading it to, you know, saying you don't qualify for Europe if you win it. What I'm saying is you've got to make it, you've got to level out the playing field. Now, you can do that in any number of ways. For instance, you can always sit and say that wherever the draw is, whoever comes out the bag first, the team in the lowest league position of the two will have the home advantage. Okay. But in essence, what you're looking at doing now is saying we don't want the big teams to win. Now, if you're saying you don't want the big teams to win a tournament, then it's almost a bit like, it's almost a bit cack-handed. So if we were sitting here and the last five winners of the FA Cup, and I'm just going to pull some names out of thin air, so no disrespect to any of these clubs, were Brighton, Huddersfield, Norwich, I don't know, Blackburn, and we'd be saying, what's up with the FA Cup? What's wrong with the FA Cup? Nobody takes it seriously anymore, and we're almost complaining. And you know, I understand. I'm right with you guys, but we're almost saying it's too important. Do you see what I'm saying? So, if we want to make it more equitable, if we want to make it a tournament that lower teams have a better advantage of win more better chance of winning, then we've got to almost not have a level playing field. We've almost got to tilt it a little bit in their favour, because as I said earlier, if the league has been run away with by one or two or three clubs, as has happened, excuse me, almost exclusively through the Premier League, it's been a two or three or five all the way through. The FA Cup becomes the biggest domestic trophy that a Premier League club can win.
I don't think it's just entirely that it's the big teams winning it all the time, although I do take your point, Gary, that has happened a lot throughout the history regardless. Yeah. But I think in the past, it didn't feel beyond other teams, whereas now it does, in the same way that the league does. But, I mean, you're right, that possibly at the end of the day, the team that's lifting it may not change that drastically, but maybe it becomes something that people can actually strive for a little bit more. I think we've possibly seen, I've got no stats to back this up at all, this is just a hunch, that there's been more finals recently between two big teams rather than smaller teams having reached the final. I could be wrong there. We only mentioned Hull and Wigan having reached the final in quite recent times and done reasonably well. But I could be wrong on that. And Paul, what are your thoughts on how it could be improved going forwards? Any potential suggestions, do you think?
Well, yeah, I mean, I agree, you know, both of what Stephen points out and what Gary said as well. I mean, I agree with the fact that, you know, I think the FA Cup needs to revamp itself. I also agree that, you know, as Gary said, we can't look through rose tinted spectacles. We can't go back to being what it was. Just a couple of points from my perspective. I found the BBC coverage of the FA Cup really, really infuriating. I mean, Man United have been on like 69 out of 70 times to be in the FA Cup. They always seem to get picked to be shown on the TV. Now, if you're trying to attract different people to get an interest in the FA Cup, why are you showing the same team all the time? Similarly, when they always tote this out, that magic of the FA Cup, the non-league teams to focus on in recent years have been FC United, and then when they went out of fashion, it was then Salford. Why not focus on some different non-league clubs? Why just stick with the same non-league team all the way through? There's some teams out there, up your part of the world, Blyth Spartans, with tremendous FA Cup pedigree. They never seem to get feast on the live game. So I think the BBC has a role to play here in expanding the game and trying to show more competitive games that are going to interest people when they're watching the FA Cup. I think the semi-finals being played at neutral ground, to me, is absolutely no-brainer. And I know we're going to talk about, you know, the lack of supporters in the FA Cup quarterfinals at present. One of the things I like about the FA Cup at the moment is that the demographic of the crowd is different from what you get at the Premier League grounds. Certainly from my experience of watching it ever since, they have, you know, cheap tickets for children and things like that for the FA Cup games. I'm sure other clubs do the same. And it's really good to be at the Cup games at home sometimes and see the young element there coming to support their hometown team, because, you know, given the average age of the Premier League supporter these days is about 44, 45, it's good to see young kids there coming to watch the game with the parents who maybe, you know, their economic situation means they can't normally take advantage of that situation. In terms of changing the competition, I mean, It's a model from the Victorian times, so it's done well to survive in its present format for as long as it can. And it's difficult. You could take the view that if the four strongest teams in the country are in the final every year, that's a reflection of the strength of competition. One thing I was wondering about was, and I don't know how possible this is, would it make sense for the Premier League teams to enter in the first round rather than the third round? So then you got more of a chance of a genuine non-league team coming to play against a Premier League side. So, for example, my local non-league team here, Marine, if they were to make the first round of the FA Cup, they would actually have an outside chance of drawing Everton or Liverpool at home. And I just think maybe the Premier League teams came in as an earlier stage. It might add a bit more to the so-called romance or magic of the FA Cup.
That's not a bad suggestion, Paul, I have to say. You know, I mean, if we're going to give, you know, to have some glamour, somebody like Marine, as you say, drawing Liverpool or Everton would be, you know, massive. You know, or you say below Spartans, perhaps getting Newcastle. So, yeah, that would be a chance, a change that would give more more glamour to the competition. And also, obviously, a not unwelcome bunch of brass for the smaller club as well.
And that's the thing we've always got to remember, that we're talking for this from a top club perspective, in largely in the discussion. But for lower league clubs, of course, it's a hugely significant source of income. A cup run for a League Two side or a National League side sets them up for the rest of the year or even beyond, doesn't it, in some cases? Or it keeps them afloat in many cases. So it's certainly vital to those beyond. So, yeah, that's a suggestion we haven't actually seen before, Paul, but I like it. It's a good one. Let's get in touch with the FA. Let's get it done. But all this reminiscing brings us neatly onto our favourite FA Cup final memories. For me to go first, it was pretty much about the whole day, as I mentioned earlier, watching the TV. So you're getting carried away with the full day's schedule devoted to the Cup final, all the daft things they had, cameras on the bus and all that kind of thing. In terms of the on-field action, though, for me, the 87 final between Coventry and Tottenham, that's one of my fondest Cup final memories. I obviously didn't have any specific to my team to fall back on, so I had to take what I could get. The names Dave Bennett and Keith Houchin seemed to me at the time to come from absolutely nowhere. They're dazzling on the grandest stage. It also came in the midst of a series of very good, or at least iconic, finals. It always seemed a special event, and it always seemed quite a good match as well, which helps. The main action would then, of course, be recreated in the back garden or on the school field the next week. You just don't get the impression that kind of thing goes on as much anymore, because it's all about Premier League and Champions League. But it was, of course, one of the few shared TV experiences in terms of football that we had in those days. So that added to the appeal. But for me, yes, that 87 final is one of my fondest Cup final memories. So, Stephen, how about you?
Oh, that was a great final, that was, yeah. And I mean, in general football watching terms, then, you know, I don't think I've enjoyed a Cup final more than that one. You know, it had everything. It had the underdog winning. I still felt for Spurs as well, because they'd had such a fantastic season with a wonderful side. Clive Allen scored 49 goals that season. It was Glenn Hoddle's swan song. You know, everything that FA Cup final was meant to be, it turned out not to be. You know, and Coventry came along and won it in such a dramatic fashion. But yeah, you know, for me, like I said earlier, you know, I grew up, the FA Cup was for other teams. You know, we went from 74 to 86, not winning it. We had a 12-year gap there. We lost the 77 final to Man United. And then we had a series of semi-final defeats, late 70s into the, you know, the start of the 1980s. Then we were being knocked out by a series of teams that we really shouldn't have been knocked out by. No disrespect, Gary, but Chelsea knocked us out, I think, twice from the second division. Brighton 2 years running, the second of those being as a second division side. And there was this general aura that, you know, we were a little bit cursed in the FA Cup. But then 86 came along, the first All Merseyside FA Cup final. We played each other in the League Cup final 2 years earlier. And it was just such a massive thing because, you know, I have cousins who are Blues. You know, some of my best mates were Blues there, you know, as a kid there. And it was just such a special thing to be able to have this kind of cup final that just belonged to the city of Liverpool. And, you know, yes, we started awfully. Gary Lineker opened the scoring, and then we came back into it in the second half via a bust up between Bruce Grobbelaar and Jim Beglin. I remember this back pass that Grobbelaar almost missed, and we snatched the ball. He pushed Beglin as if to say, you know, wake up, concentrate, when he was as much to fault than Beglin was. And within minutes, we'd equalised. You know, within 5 minutes, we were leading. And then Rush scored again, the iconic one where he hits it into the corner and the little small television cameras went wheeling away into the distance. Yeah. And it was such a special day. And yes, we won it, but I can remember going out and, like you say, kicking a ball around after the match, and there was no gloating. You know, amongst me with and my Liverpool supporter mates with the Everton fans, you know, and it was just a very different era back then, and yeah, that's always stayed with me. I can remember that day, you know, very, very vividly. You know, and the traditional way was you know, decorating the house, the front of the house in red and white for us, but blue and white for plenty of others, It was cup final day as it was, and it wasn't even cup final day back then. It was cup final week. You know, there would be a huge build up to you know, that there would always be an injury concern. You know, about a player, would he be fit? Wouldn't he be fit? For ours on the 86 cup final day, it was Gary Gillespie went down with a stomach bug on the morning of the game, which ruled him out. But there was always these incidents, and they just felt very, very huge as well, and it's that sense of occasion that has been lost. You know, that was what the FA Cup final had. It's what televised football had back then, because it was a rarity. You know, it was becoming more prevalent, but it still felt like something huge when a game was televised, a live game, and the FA Cup final was the biggest of the lot. And yeah, that 86 final, you know, is where it's at for me.
Paul, is the 86 final one of your fondest cup final memories?
Both the 86 final and the 89 final disappeared from my consciousness. but I hope Gary likes my FA Cup memory, because it's not Everton related. But when I was at school, one of my friends was a massive, massive Chelsea fan. And when it came to the evening of the 1970 FA Cup replay between Chelsea and Leeds United, he came up to me at break time on the school playground. I said, "Paul, I've got a spare ticket for the replay at Manchester at Old Trafford tonight. Do you want to go?" But obviously, the only answer there is yes. I definitely want to come. So we met at Lime Street Station. We got the train across to Old Trafford. And I was in the Stretford End with all the Chelsea fans with my mate Rob. And I couldn't believe the support that Chelsea had for that game, given they'd had to come from London for the match and Leeds United would come across from the Pennines. I'd say the Chelsea supporters outnumbered Leeds by about 2-1. I also remembered as well that when Everton played the semi-final in 68, having your fans in the covered Stretford End compared to the open scoreboard end was such a massive, massive advantage. And I remember the whole experience vividly. You know, the game swung, you know, Leeds' way, then Chelsea's way. And I know people look back at it now and say it was full of, you know, dirty football, fouls, etc. It might seem even a bit like that in extra time, but for most of the game, it was a pretty free-flowing game. And, you know, Chelsea did really well to come back. You have the situation where Benassi had been injured by Mick Jones, who couldn't take the goal kicks. And then, of course, Chelsea got the winning goal when Ian Hutchinson took a long throw, and Jackie Charlton, who should have been marking David Webb, had gone off to kick somebody who just kicked him before and didn't know his role at the back of the defence there. So the game had everything. And I think it's after the World Cup, it's the second most watched football game on TV. And also, when the 90 minutes were up in that FA Cup final, for the next 30 minutes, Manchester City were holders of the FA Cup, the League Cup, and the European Cup Winners' Cup. And I don't think that's ever happened in football history before. At the end of the game, because it went to extra time, we couldn't get a train back to Liverpool. So we had to hitch back, and we were 14 years old at the time. We hitched back from Manchester to Liverpool, got back to Liverpool about 2 a.m, and then we were walking back to our respective houses because there's no transport or anything, and our parents didn't have cars to pick us up. The police pulled over. where you going, lads? Well, we just come back from the FA Cup final at Manchester. We're watching your bag, open your bags up. So we opened our bags up, showed them the programme, showed them the scarves, showed them the souvenirs. Oh, well done, lads. Tell you what, where do you live? So we live a little in a few miles away. Jump in the car, I'll give you a lift back home. Brilliant. So it was a really perfect end to a tremendous evening out.
Fantastic. Very, very fortunate to get yourself in that situation. Sounds absolutely fantastic.
Oh, it was, I think we'd all agree, you kind of, your boyhood memories going to watch football matches are the ones that kind of stick in my memory more now than the more recent games I've been to.
Indeed. And Gary, how about you? Obviously, the cup final with Chelsea's involvelment back then would be a good memory for you. But what's your fondest recollection from the cup finals in the past?
Just want to touch on a couple of ones there. I mean, the 87 one sticks in my mind as well. It was my son was born a few days afterwards. But Brazil were due to play England later. Well, I think the following week at Wembley, and the Brazilian team watched the final, and they couldn't believe that Dave Bennett wasn't a regular England international, the commentary winger. Just an interesting little sideline. I mean, my sort of memory goes, but I can remember the Spurs, Leicester Spurs burned the game in the early 60s, but probably the first cup final memory I've got is the West Ham 3 Preston 2, which I think Howard Kendall played. He was the youngest ever FA Cup finalist, I think. Would that be right, mate?
Yeah, and also, as fate would have it, if Man United had won their semi-final, George Best and Howard Kendall were born on the same day, so they'd both been the youngest players together playing in the final.
Yeah, but if I'm going to pick one, I'd pick 70. It sticks in my mind, as I mentioned earlier, and Leeds were always our big rivals in the 70s, early part of the 70s, and so that game, and as Paul mentioned about Jackie Charlton, it's interesting, he sort of almost comes full circle, and Dave Webb getting that goal, and I remember getting up, I mean, that's really weird, I remember getting up when Webb scored, kicking the settee, and my dad gave me a cussing over it. things that stick in your mind, but that was a massive thing, it certainly sticks in my mind. And, we've won the FA Cup a number of times since, especially since the turn of the century. But if I'm going to pick one, I'd definitely pick that one.
Great stuff. Okay, well, who knows what new chapters we've written in this lengthy cup saga in the coming weeks. It'll certainly be a slightly different experience, that's for sure. Yeah. But now, though, it's a chance for you guys to pick the subjects yourselves, chance to take over, bring anything up you like. Could be something topical, something affecting the game in general, something affecting your club. Or simply to climb aboard a soapbox and rant away. So anything goes. So Stephen, over to you.
Oh, that's so many I could pick from. So many. We could. I think we need to do a soapbox special, basically. But yeah, for me, it's the repetitive winning of league titles is just really, really, really annoying. Juventus are on the brink of a ninth Serie A in a row, and it's just not how football should be. Bayern Munich have just won an eighth successive Bundesliga title. Celtic have been handed their ninth successive SPL. I just don't see where hope kind of like just vanishes for teams. In that respect, Liverpool winning the title for the first time in 30 years is going by being a saviour for football this season, in some respects. You're going to look at Spain, the last 16 titles handed out, and I think Real Madrid are on the brink of winning it tonight. Only one of them hasn't gone to Real Madrid or Barcelona. You're getting so many leagues that are won before they've started. I've tongue-in-cheek put out a tweet on the opening day of seasons when like Bayern Munich have won and said, oh, well, there you go, the Bundesliga's over. But it's got an element of truth in it because it's just a foregone conclusion. And, football, I'm not sure how long people will be able to although the patience is going to run out for a lot of people. When you're considering how much you've got to pay for a sports subscription to watch some of these leagues, to watch some of these games, people are going to find themselves exhausted by it. PSG are another one. They've won 7 out of 8 in France. So it's not just a case of the smaller leagues anymore. You know, Olympiakos's, you know, epic domination in Greece, where it stretches to about 19 or 20 leagues won in the last 23 or 24. I just football's built on hope, and if you remove the hope, then what's the point? So this is where, you know, for me, I'm very much an advocate of a European Super League in that respect, if it can be done in conjunction with the domestic game still playing. You know, if you can take the biggest teams that are walking away with these leagues and make them play midweek in a league where they've got to play against, you know, the like-for-like teams from different countries, and then go back and play a domestic game, you know, to stretch them domestically. You know, I'd happily have them play in a European Super League in the middle of the week and then come back and play Watford, you know, come back and play Brighton, and it will be a different matter. You know, I think football needs something that will, you know, stop the monopolisation of it, because it's going to kill it.
That's a topic we could delve into at great length, isn't it? I think we should probably flag that down on the list for a big discussion in one of these pods in the future, because that's certainly it's certainly a hot topic, quite prevalent instances, as you say, across Europe of some of the dominant clubs. But yeah, we might get into that one in more depth on another occasion. So Gary, over to you now. What's your soapbox subject of choice?
I mean, I just fully agree with everything Steve just said. It's worth me chucking that in first. But I want to sort of talk about something positive. So, incidentally, Real Madrid are winning today, and if they win, that's it. But I think they need a point, actually, to lock the league out. Manuel Pellegrini has been appointed to manage Real Betis in Seville. And I just want to sort of... Real Betis have been struggling over the last few years, trying to compete with the success of Sevilla. And I just want to sort of talk about how well Sevilla have done and why they've done so well. And this perhaps is, you know, it might be the sort of thing that sort of, you know, Stevie says, you know, it's important to have hope. This sort of thing does give hope. From 97 to 2001, Sevilla were in the Segunda Division, the second tier, and they hadn't had a top half finish in the top tier since 1995. Then a guy called Ramon Rodriguez Verdejo, often more commonly known as Monchi, arrived as director of football. And his transfer strategy of buying cheap, selling expensively, picking up bargains and transforming a team has been fundamental to the success of this club. So he arrived and Sevilla won the Segunda that season, and they finished in the top half of the league every season since. And all this has been done without being bankrolled by a billionaire. This club almost makes a profit on their transfers. In that period, Sevilla have only missed out on European competition once in the last 17 seasons. So how good is that? Well, it's a better record than Atletico Madrid, better than PSG, better than Bayern Munich, better than Liverpool, better than Borussia Dortmund, better than either of the Milan clubs, and better than Juventus. Plus, if you consider the Champions League and the Europa League as, not equivalent, but European titles, Sevilla have won more European titles than any other club in Europe. So when Manuel Pellegrini arrives at Betis, you've got a bit of struggle on your own there, Sunshine, because I just think it's a wonderful story of how a club, I mean, this isn't Barcelona, this isn't Real Madrid, it's not even Atletico or Valencia. You know, and many people outside of Spain look at Sevilla as being like, you know, a mid-ranking team. This has been an exceptionally well-run football club and almost a model for achieving the things that, you know, Stevie was just mentioning.
Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah, good one to highlight there, Gary. So over to you, Paul. What's your chosen subject?
Yeah, well, I think I'll follow Gary's theme here. I totally agree with what Stephen said about, you know, the league's being dominated by one club. That's, you know, it's not good for European football in general. But I'll go for a heartwarming story, and I think it's only right. We talked about the National League before. It's only right to mention, you know, that Barrow AFC are back in the Football League after a long absence of almost 48 years since they were there. They controversially lost their place, partly due to Newcastle United, and they had it, when Hereford United were elected to take their place in the Football League, despite the fact on the first round of votes, the two clubs were tied. And according to the Football League rules, I think that should have meant that Barry should have stayed up, but they had a second ballot and Hereford got in. And Hereford hadn't even won their own league at that time. Chelmsford City won the league. So it's always been a bit of a bad feeling on Barrow about that. So it's just really good that one of the so-called, you know, depressed areas of the UK, whose Football League team, you know, they've lost their status for 48 years, have actually got themselves back into the Football League. Because if you think back to the 1970s, lots of northern towns lost their league status. Bradford Park Avenue, Southport, Workington, Barrow. And it's good to see that at least one of those clubs have got themselves back into the Football League. So I just think that's a really heartwarming story. Delighted for the town. Always got a huge affection for Barrow because my dad used to work there from Mondays to Fridays and come back home at the weekends. So I've got, sad with that I am, I've got a collection of about 400 Barrow programs in my garage lying around. So always had a soft spot for the team. Brilliant that they're back in the Football League. And it's just a blow that their manager's gone and left to join Bolton Wanderers. But it just shows there's always hope in football. You know, for 48 years, you could be out of the Football League and think, there's no way we're going to get back. There's no way I'm going to see my team come back to the Football League. And, you know, as an Everton fan who's gone nearly sort of 33 years without us winning the Premier League or the First Division, as was, it just gives hope. So for every supporter of a team that's gone through hard times, look at the example of Barrow FC, because there's always a way back.
Wonderful stuff. Wonderful stuff. Nice and heartwarming. Good to hear. So moving on, we're getting towards the end now, but there's plenty more going on at these Football Times at the moment, just to flag a few things up for people's attention. Our next magazine has been launched recently, which is a bit of a step away from the club series we've been engaged in over the last 18 months or so. I think it's been now. To look at the language of football, focusing on 10 key countries in world football and the frequently fascinating and unusual phrases used when discussing football in those cultures. So it's quite an exciting and different project for us. So it's had contributors from all over the world who know these cultures really well. So that's quite an interesting one to look up for. I think there's a handful of copies left. So if that piques your interest, get along to our online store and have a look at that one. There's also prints of the iconic Liverpool magazine cover available on the online store, I believe, which is the Sergeant Pepper inspired cover creation that triggered plenty of discussion back when that one came out a little while ago. On the podcast front, it's great we've got Gary here today, because you've recently just recorded the final political football podcast in what, series 5, was it, Gary, now?
Yeah, that's right. We've just gone through the World Cup. From 1930 to obviously the one coming in 2022. It's our fifth series, and Stu and myself have done, I don't know, I'm counting up at 40 or 50 episodes, and you know, we don't want to bore people, so we just decided we'll sort of call it hold to that. But it's been a fantastic, some amazing guests we've had over the time, and going across the world back in the past and into the future. So that's been an absolute joy. So I think we've got last two episodes still to come out, so keep an eye for those guys.
Yeah, they should be out soon. So anyone who thinks politics and sport haven't got much to do with each other should just take a look through that collection. There's a huge number, as you say, from all over the world on subjects that where politics have come into football in areas you'd scarcely have thought of. It's fascinating stuff. Over on our YouTube channel also, there's a couple of other things coming up, which I'd urge you all to subscribe to, of course. There's another of the looks back at a classic match from the Euros. The third of the trilogy will be coming up soon. Looking at England and Romania in Euro 2000 and what went wrong there for England. There's continuation of the South America files too, that there'll be more episodes of that coming up soon. Plus, of course, there's all sorts of online articles on the website, as always. This includes the recently concluded Euros retrospective, which was Stephen's brainchild. So as with the last time around, we're each going to pick one of our recent articles from the website that we took an interest in. To flag up for people's attention. So, Stephen, what's your choice this time?
Yes, I'll opt for the Euro series and Stuart's piece on the France-Portugal game from 1984. You know, we've had a lot of connotations to that recently. We did that YouTube vlog for it as well. But yeah, he nailed it. It was absolutely brilliant. Love the references to the fact that the BBC and ITV opted to show so little of that tournament, yet it to be such an iconic tournaments in the end as well. And yeah, I just absolutely loved that.
Excellent. Yeah, it was great to go over that one again for the video series recently. Something on the YouTube channel that we all got to enjoy that game again.
Yeah, never tire of that game. So, you know, get over to YouTube and see how we dissected it.
And read Stu's article, of course, as well. Indeed. How about you, Paul?
Yeah, I've gone along with Stephen as well. I picked one from the Euro Retrospective series, which I have to say was a brilliant idea from Stephen as well. I've gone for an article by Brian Penn. It's the report on the Sweden beating England 2-1, which meant the end of Gary Lineker's England career and certainly set in motion the eventual end of Graham Taylor's England career. But one thing that stood out for me from the report, you know, was the references to Thomas Brolin and that pirouette when he scored the second winning goal. And it always, you know, it always brings back memories of that competition for me, because sometimes in the competition, a bit like Tosa Scalacci in the World Cup in 1990, you get a player who, for one competition, it's just his moments in time. Everything's just fallen into place. And in Euro 92, Thomas Brolin was the guy who came from nowhere to suddenly be the star player of the competition. His career really didn't take off a great deal after that, but it's good to reflect on what a huge talent he was. And he was a world... In that competition, he was a world removed from the player that Leeds signed a few seasons later. So that's my choice.
It's half the man, literally. Excellent. That's a good one, Paul. Right, Gary, over to you. What's your choice?
Well, I've gone for a Spanish football one. It's a Juan Mateo. You know, if you want to read Spanish football, Juan's the guy. It's about the... when Real Madrid lost Roberto Carlos, and how are you going to replace Roberto Carlos? Well, they found this other Brazilian called Marcelo. And, you know, it's a great article about how difficult people thought it was going to be. And, you know, to many people, Roberto Carlos will be a legend. But what Marcelo's done for Real Madrid is amazing. How do you replace a legend? You replace him with another legend.
Indeed, indeed. Well, for myself, for my pick, speaking of legends, I've changed the one I was originally going to pick, because there's been new articles coming out each day, of course, and one of those was the Triumph and Troubles of Socrates, speaking of legendary players, but it also focused on how he ended his career in West Yorkshire. This is by Stephen Bell on the website now. Socrates is such a remarkable player, of course, but this takes us through his career, highs and lows. But as I say, it focuses at the beginning and the end on Garforth Town and some lovely scene setting around how he got there, how cold he was at the side of the pitch, and this bizarre twist in his career. So it's a really good read about who's a fascinating person as well as a great player. But there's plenty more online to discover. So, I'd encourage everyone to get over there and see what they can dig out. But that just about wraps it up for today. So all that remains is a huge thank you to all of our guests. Paul, great to have you on. Thanks for your insights into the past glories of the Cup and everything else besides.
Well, thanks for having me on, Aidan. And it's good to see that These Football Times now has a serious rival as a podcast host to Stuart.
Oh, steady. He makes this seem rather easier than it is. But thank you all the same. Gary, thanks to you too. A quick prediction before you go. Will Chelsea be adding another Cup final win in the coming weeks?
You know, we played Man United four times this season. At least three times, and lost every one. We're due to beat them. I fancy us. You know, it'd be a good game, because they're ripping on form at the moment, but it'd be a good game. So, yeah, I fancy our chances. And, thanks for having me on tonight. It's been great. And I can only echo that, Steve's got a rival here.
We'll see. And Stephen, thanks again. No cup glory for Liverpool this year, but I'm sure you'll get over that.
Yeah, we'll manage that this year. But looking forward to the games this weekend, actually. So, it's very open plan. Yeah, it's four big teams, but, you know, pick your winner. Who knows?
Indeed. It'll be interesting to see how it goes. But big thank you to all our listeners too. So I hope you'll join us all again next time. But for now, that's it. And so thanks for being on. And we'll speak to you next time. Thanks and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.